Okay, so I'm going to talk about some work I've done over the summer with my student Kasia Budzik, on the role of D-brains in twisted holography. So twisted holography is a setup which is mathematically understandable. It's an holographic setup which is mathematically understandable on both sides of the duality. So in principle, I guess I could give a purely mathematical talk, but instead I will devote a good half of it to explaining the physical motivations and context for the work. So twisted holography essentially captures a protected piece of the standard holographic duality between N equal 4 superior Mills and tight 2B string theory. This sector, it's independent of the coupling, which means you can do calculations essentially in the free quantum field theory, but it still has all the richness of the large N expansion. And so there is still something interesting there. And entertainingly, this means that somehow the whole geometry of the holographic dual setup should arise just from the large N combinatorics of a free field theory. And you know, the reason this is interesting, besides having a nice and computable example of holography, is that understanding the holographic dual of free or weakly coupled in Mills theory is one of the interesting and somewhat open questions in holography. There has been some recent progress by work of Gopakumar and Gabardiel and others, but the question of what is the holographic dual of weakly coupled or free Yamil's theory is still not fully understood. In the work, in the original work with Kevin on this twisted holography setup, we focused on closed strings, on correlation functions of operators which are dual to closed strings propagating in the holographic dual. Which is a B model, a topological B model, whose target space is SL2C. In this work, instead, we try to focus on a situation where there are D brains in the bulk. In particular, giant gravitons are a very specific type of brains, which occur in the following context. Sorry, I'm finding it a little bit trickier than I thought to speak for a long time with a mask. So let me just depict ADS phi times phi this way. Let's say this is Euclidean ADS phi times phi. And inside this space, we're going to study a situation where there are some D brains, D3 brains, more precisely. These D3 brains wrap a four-dimensional manifold inside this 10-dimensional space-time. And the constraint we want to impose is that when they approach the boundary of ADS5 and S5, they should take a very specific form, which is that one of the so-called giant graviton, which means that near the boundary, M4 should be approximately of the form R plus times S3. And this R plus lives inside ADS5, and this S3 lives inside S5. Right, so I'm sort of given this boundary condition. I want my D brain to go to the boundary at a variety, at a collection of points. And near those points, it should behave in a very specific way, wrapping a certain S3. And I can pick different choices of S3 at different asymptotic boundary directions. Now, because the D brain approaches the boundary at one point, according to the holographic dictionary, in the dual CFT, this must correspond to the insertion of a local operator. So essentially what's going on is that in the quantum field theory, we are studying a correlation function of certain operators which tell the holographic dual that there should be a D-brain ending in that point, and ending at that point. And in the large N limit, this correlation function is controlled by the property of some actual D-brain solution, which has these boundary conditions. So the operators, which appear, are known. So it's known, or at least conjectured, what sort of operator forces holographic dual to have a D-brain ending at the boundary. These are determinant operators. Sorry. So, what's going on? So, N equal 4 super Mills has 6 scalar fields. No, phi 1 all the way to phi 6. I'm taking a complex linear combination of the scalar fields. I want this vector that controls the linear combination to be null. These are n by n matrices. I take a certain linear combination of them. I add a multiple of the identity. And I take the determinant of this n by n matrix. And this defines a local operator in the quantum field theory. Roughly, the real and imaginary part of this vector tell you how the S3 is oriented inside S5. Tell you the direction of the S3. And this parameter controls roughly the size of the S3. But when this parameter is zero, the S3 is an equator. And as you increase this parameter, the sphere becomes smaller and smaller, and sort of goes towards the pole. So in principle, a correlation function of a collection of these determinant operators . Let me say K of them. It's each with its own choice of position and direction and size should be controlled essentially by the action in the large N limit by the action of some D3 brain in the bulk, the classical action, multiplying a certain power series in 1 over n, which is just the string theory amplitude for type 2B string theory in ADS5 times S5 in the presence of this brain. Okay. Are there any questions? Okay. So I should stress that in general, given these boundary conditions of going at the boundary in specific ways, there will be multiple possible for manifolds that satisfy the equations of motion and go to the boundary in the correct way. So, in particular, you typically get to look for solutions with different degree of connectivity. For example, I might find a solution where each of these giant gravitons sort of smoothly closes off in the interior. Or perhaps a solution where two or more are connected, and the other, I mean, where there are different groups of operators are connected with each other, but not the other groups. So typically, I can, at the very least, look for a different solution for every choice of connectivity. And even when I have this, a specific pattern of connectivity, there might be multiple solutions. And the expectation is that there will be some sort of Stokes phenomenon in this large n limit, so that this is roughly a sum over solutions or some exponentials of this sort. Although you might have Stokes phenomena, meaning that, you know, maybe there will be a dominant saddle that contributes and subdominal saddles might come in and go out in a complicated way. Today, I will not concern myself at all with questions of dominance among saddles. I will just try to study individual saddles. And yeah, it's sort of striking that, you know, a correlation function of relatively simple operators in the large n limit might produce such a complicated structure. And you might think that this structure only emerges when I go at strong coupling and there is an actual, you know, smooth geometry, big RDS5, in which I can draw my D-brains. But actually, it was realized by Shota and other collaborators, Shota Komatsu and other collaborators, that the situation is even more interesting than that, meaning that the existence of different saddles on the right-hand side is already visible in the free theory. So the large n combinatorics alone is sufficient to give you interesting saddles in these correlation functions. And that makes it very plausible that we should be able to find something interesting in a twisted holography context where the calculations involve the free theory anyway. So in a twisted holography setup, ADS5 times S5 would be replaced by SL2C. And these four-dimensional manifolds will be replaced by holomorphic curves inside SL2C. And you can specify certain boundary conditions here too, like, I don't know, sigma 2 looks like C star as it approaches the boundary of SL2C. Specific C stars inside SL2C. And so the challenge of today is to understand in detail, not just on a sort of qualitative way, but in a quantitative and precise way, how the saddles of a calculation like this might be related to holomorphic curves in SL2C, and more precisely, B-brains in SL2C. Are there any questions? Okay. So I will keep doing a few calculations remaining in the general physical setup of a free Young-Mills theory and then specialize to the twisted holography setup because the calculations are really identical on a formal point of view until the very end. Maybe I should have kept this. Actually, you know what? I'll keep this. I'll keep this particular cell. Okay. Oof.
Can you hear me, Davide, since you are keeping? Can I ask a question? Can you hear me?
Yes, sure, go ahead.
Okay. So you kept the only picture that I was confused about. Shouldn't this be connected, this correlator? Does this exist?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
This looks like four disconnected things, the figure that you kept. Don't you need to have some connectivity?
No, actually. So it's perfectly possible when M is non-zero, it's perfectly possible for a giant graviton to have a one-point function. It's silly, of course, right? If I could say, okay, the determinant of M plus X expectation value is just m to the n. It is
but
a complex scalar.
You would draw
scalar.
It as a picture in AVS? You would draw that as a picture? No.
Yeah, it's a yeah, point. Yeah, yeah. And you can evaluate the action. You know, you can look for the action of a membrane that looks like this, and you can reproduce this. You know, this is e to the m log n. And you can easily write down a solution for a giant graviton which has this action.
And now I'm really confused because that is just the identity, right? It's determinant of identity that you are computing, right?
Yep.
But determinant of identity, you are not inserting anything. You are not telling me that doing nothing is putting a deep brain.
I'm telling you that there is a deep brain in ADS5 times S5, which goes to the boundary just the right way, and it has an action log m.
No, but sorry, I cannot believe. Maybe I'm wrong, but you are computing expectation value of one.
Yes, that's right.
How could expectation value of a number correspond to putting anything anyway? It's a number.
Well, I could have also done something more interesting, right? I could have put, say, trace of y to the n. Right? Then this would have given m to the n minus n times some function of n. And this would have been computed by something like that.
Oh, then yes. Then yes. Because you are putting a source. Then it's fine. But the picture you were drawing was like four blobs. I really don't understand.
Yeah, I'm saying that if I do correlation function of a product of traces and a single determinant of m plus x, okay, then I claim that this goes like e to like m to the n, which is really e to the n as classical, times something. And this something is reproduced by a string theory calculation with this brain. Now, suppose now I do the same thing with many traces, but I put two determinants, trace of m plus x, determinant m plus x, and determinant of m prime plus y. Yeah, sorry, for the audience, here x was something like phi 1 plus I phi 2, and maybe y is phi, I don't know.
Maybe put x. I'm still confused. I'm still confused about what you are saying. Can you hear me still?
Yes.
So when n is very large, that determinant operator becomes determinant of m.
Yes.
Plus small corrections.
Yes.
The determinant of m is a number. A
exactly.
Number I take out of the average.
Yeah, is m to the n, which happens to be the classical action of the brain. And the small corrections reproduce string theory in the presence of these D-brains. Or these D-brains.
Sorry, I'm sorry, maybe I'm missing something basic, but that's good because then I will learn it. But when n is large, that determinant is a number. Then I take that number, I take it out. And then I have expectation value of the traces without that number anymore.
No, because the determinant has still a bunch of x. I mean, when you expand out the determinant,
If m is large, determinant of m is the leading one. The other ones are small corrections that are small. So it's not a big blob. It's a small blob.
Yeah, but it's you might think that if m is large enough, the first m will dominate and the rest will be immaterial. What happens is this D brain extends in by an amount controlled by m. So if m is very, very large, the D brain looks like a tiny blob that just gets away barely from the boundary. And that's almost the same as a local operator inserted at the boundary.
Ah, okay. When that I understand. When n is large, if you draw it like that, I agree. That is fine.
So clearly you can expand this out, right? The determinant of m plus x, right, is e to the trace of the log of m plus x, right? So this, you can think about this as a generating function of traces. That is true. But these are traces with a bit of a funny normalization, right? Because usually the traces will be normalized with a 1 over n in front. So you write this as n times 1 over n log.
No, I think I will agree with the formulas, but I don't like when n is large drawing a big blob. That sounds strange to me. But right
no,
now,
no,
you
no,
do it
no,
as a small
I, no,
you do it as a small
I disagree.
Blob, then I'm happy.
No, as long as m is finite and not strictly infinite, this blob extends out by an infinite amount from the boundary. Okay? Because the boundary is infinitely far.
That's fine, but then it has no connection with a 1-point function.
Sorry?
But for the 1-point function, the only thing that contributes is the infinitesimal blob, because it's just the m to infinity limit.
It's still a Dibrain, okay? You know, it's m to the n. M to the n, you know, it's e to the n times something. It's a disk. Anyway, if you put true determinants, then you have two saddles. There will be a saddle that looks like this, and you're free to draw the blobby as small as you want, but it's there, it is infinitely big in an infinitely far boundary. And then there will be another saddle which looks like this. And depending on which scalars are you putting here and on the values of m, there will be a wall crossing at some point where one saddle takes over the other. You know, ultimately, you know, the most extreme case is doing just determinant of x, determinant of x bar. This is definitely controlled by this. On the other hand, where m and m prime are large, is controlled by this. Yes. Yep. Yes. That's the picture I have. I mean, when I write something like this, right? When I write something like this, I mean string theory in the presence of these D-brains. Okay? So a picture like this means the partition function of type should be string theory decorated by the brain wrapping, you know, by these brains. So absolutely, here I have the classical action and all the corrections which come from exchanging strings and gravitons and whatnot. And there will be open strings and other things. Okay. Very good. So I would like to illustrate how Shota and his collaborators got the saddles already in the free theory. So it's remarkably simple to see why a determinant corresponds to the insertion of a D-brain. That part is very intuitive. The determinant of something like this can be rewritten as a fermionic integral. Right? This is pretty intuitive. So in principle, I can take my local operators, and for each operator, introduce 2n fermions. They just live at that point, they're zero-dimensional degrees of freedom, and use them to exponentiate my determinant. This is actually very convenient also for describing deformations of the determinant, but I will come to that later. So the whole correlation function of determinants can now be rewritten as a path integral over the connection, the fermion, the giginos, the scalars, and whatnot, which are the fields of N=4 supermills. And then the finite dimensional integral over these fermions, and you know, e to the action Euler-Mills plus these couplings. And when you write it like this, it's quite obvious that I'm going to get D-brains. Why? So at this point, you know, all the fields have a nice kinetic term, as long as m's are non-zero. I'll come back to this later. And so I can just do Feynman diagrams. I do my Feynman diagrams. I use the double line notation. I use Tuft combinatorics. You know, I write double lines for the joint fields. I write single lines for the vector, for the fundamental and anti-fundamental fields. And all Feynman diagrams can be sort of collected by their genus. So once I fill in the color loops, the degree of, you know, the Feynman diagram will look like a Riemann surface with a bunch of boundaries. And the power of n in the expansion will be controlled by the genus, like 2 - 2G, minus the number of boundaries. So it's pretty clear that the expansion in Feynman diagrams for this object is described by string theory in the presence of some D-brains. Now, because there are no terms that sort of mix the different flavor of fermions, and the boundaries come from closed loop of fermions, I really get different types of boundaries, one for each fermion, one for each of the original operators. So if I just do the naive Tuft expansion, or this path integral, I will always get these kind of saddles. I would like to show how to get the other types of saddles using Schotter's. And as I was saying, this can be done in the free theory. So from now on, I'm going to turn off interactions and study this problem. So the only interactions are really the vertices between the fermions and the scalars of N=4 supermills. So once I go to the free theory, evaluating this path integral is very easy. I just do weak contractions. When I do weak contractions, I'm going to pick up, you know, quadrilinears of the fermions, because each phi is contracted with a psi and psi bar. When I contract two phis, each of them will bring a couple of fermions, and I'll end up with a four fermion term. So the result of this integral is that I'm left with an integral over the fermions with a quartic action, which roughly looks like this. There is an important 1 over n that comes from the n in front of the action. And here I get something like the two-point function. Let me give a name of something. So when I do the weak contraction, I need a two-point function of scalar fields. particular, I need to be able to do this. Okay, this is something very simple. There is a contraction of the two vectors over the distance squared. But now let me just call this GAB. Okay, so I get something like, on the other end, GAB, psi bar psi AB, psi bar psi BA. So let me just make sure this is clear. So this A and B refer to indices which run from 1 to k. They're just labeled the operators I put in the correlation function. I've not written that. I always submit the color indices, which are contracted here. So each of these parentheses is a sum of n terms. Now, there is a standard trick to process this kind of integral further called Haber-Stratonovich transformation. And essentially involves adding some auxiliary degrees of freedom to make the fermionic integral Gaussian. Now, if I'm not careful, you will not be able to see this part of the blackboard, right? Okay. So I'm going to introduce some bosonic degrees of freedom. Can I just write one formula and then? And I'm sorry, there are a lot of formulae for a brief moment, but I really need to write them down. So I'm going to introduce k times k matrix of degrees of freedom. Well, really k squared minus k, because I don't put the diagonal ones. So then now I just have a nice Gaussian action for the fermions. And a quadratic action. So you see, right? So if I integrate away the rows with this quadratic action, it's a Gaussian integral, and I end up getting the square of this. So going from here to here is quite straightforward. Now the integral over the fermions is Gaussian, and we can integrate away the fermions too to get to the final answer, which is now just an integral over rho. So there is e to the AB inverse YB rho BA. And then when I integrate with the fermions, I get a big determinant. There are n of these fermions for each flavor, so I get the nth power of the determinant. Okay. And the crucial observation is that I have two terms. They both are to the power of n, so they both contribute to the large n limit. So if I was to ignore this, then this integral will be silly. It will be controlled by a saddle where rho AB is zero. You can convince yourself that this is the original saddle, the naive saddle, that the naive Feynman-Diagram expansion would give you. But now I have new saddles because I might find other critical points of this. So to study this, the saddle or the free correlation function, I need to find the extrema.
How many saddles do you have for the two-point function, David?
Sorry?
How many saddles do you have for the two-point function?
For the two-point function, I think there is only two, which is either separated or joined. For the three-point function, I'm trying to remember, there is probably still only one connected one, but nobody quite understands how to solve the problem for any number of operators. I mean, the equations are not that bad. Let me just write them down, okay? So for A different from B, the equation tell me that rho AB is equal to GAB times rho inverse, times the inverse of this matrix. Let me write it like this. So let me just define, it's actually convenient to...
I thought for the 2 points it was only one saddle. So
there is also the split one.
Previous confusion.
There is also the split one. Because there is, let me just write the equations and I'll describe immediately. Let me just define the matrix rho such that rho AA is just MA and rho AB are just the ones we were using before, okay? So the equations now tell you that rho AB is GAB rho inverse AB. These are the subtle equations, very innocent. But unfortunately, because there is an inverse and a multiplication element-wise, these are not nice matrix equations. They involve a matrix, but they really don't use the matrix structure. And they are tricky to solve. But just by staring at them, you should be able to convince yourself that if you take your matrix rho to be block diagonal, put zeros everywhere away from some block diagonals, then you can solve this equation by solving it in this block, and in this block separately. So you always get so you can always decompose the problem, partition the operators in group, and solve the problem within each group. And the conjecture is that this corresponds to the connectivity of the D-brains. So that a saddle.
But then, Shota was missing some of these saddles, right? Because I think
Shota had one saddle. Shota definitely says, okay, from now on, we look at connected saddles.
Ah, okay.
We look at the diagonal at the matrix, which is not block diagonal.
Ah, okay.
I think I've read it some time ago, but I'm pretty sure it's not a.
Okay. Maybe I only saw the formulas, yeah. Because okay, good. So if he says that, then I'm less confused. Okay.
So this is nice, but of limited usefulness yet, right? We've seen it in the free gauge theory. We find a lot of interesting saddles, potentially, with various connectivity properties, which seem, and you can study the expansion around these saddles and convince yourself that they look like a string theory in the presence of D-brains, one for each connected component. But unfortunately, we don't know the holographic dual of the free theory. And when you turn on interactions, the picture gets deformed. At weak coupling, you can imagine that the action for rho gets more complicated, perhaps. But really, when the couplings become finite, it's not even clear to me that rho are the right variables to integrate in. Effectively, what this rho is doing is that it allows you to study a situation where fermion bilinears are getting a VEV. And, I can imagine that if more complicated combinations of bilinears, maybe with some fields inserted inside, get a VEV, I might need to introduce fields dual to that to study the saddles. But anyway, I've not looked at the problem in detail, so I don't want to say anything I don't know about. What I'm going to do from now on is to shift to the twisted holography setup, where I don't need to care about interactions. What does it mean concretely? Concretely, it means that I'm putting two restrictions on the operators I consider. So, So first of all, I take my operators to live in a plane inside R4, a complex plane. So my positions will become of the form real part of Z, imaginary part of Z, 0, 0. And I also constrain the direction, which linear combinations of scalar fields am I allowed to use. So I'm only going to use 4 of the components of N. Ignore the last 2. Now, N, you know, a vector for SO4 can be seen as a B-spinner because a spin 4 is the same as SO2. In other words, this N could be rearranged into a 2x2 matrix. And what I'm going to do is to take an N, and notice N squared equal to 0 now means that N is actually a tensor product of 2 things. And I'm going to require that N is actually a tensor product of some generic vector in the first factor, but a very specific vector in the second factor, which depends on the position. So this is the insight of Rastelli, Beam, and collaborators, that if you tie up the R-symmetry labels to the position labels on the plane, nice things happen. And you can see nice things happening just by looking at this expression, right? The inner product of the 2 ends becomes something like VA minus VB, Z bar A minus Z bar B. And the distance squared becomes absolute value of ZA minus ZB squared. But that's the same as, that becomes purely holomorphic. So the Z bar dependence drops out. And the claim is that all calculations can be done ignoring the coupling and treating these linear combinations as if they were linear combinations of chiral fields. Correlation functions are just holomorphic. More precisely, n dot phi reduces to something like an, you know, x of z plus v times y of z. So there are 2 chiral fields, which for the ones who, for people who know what that mean, they form a beta gamma system in 2 dimensions, value in the joint of the gauge group. And so the correlation function we are studying is not a correlation function of things of this form. So the determinant of m plus x plus v times y. And they're going to be holomorphic function of the Z. Now, something very nice happens to the saddle point equations when I do this simplification, because this becomes the ratio of 2 differences. I can write the equations like this. They were supposed to have G inverse, so I'm going to get ZA minus ZB and VA minus VB. So the equations are a little bit easier. And what I really like about these equations is that now they're really matrix equations. They're not pretend matrix equations. Meaning I can define matrix, which is the diagonal. A diagonal matrix which entries VA, and another matrix zeta, which is a diagonal matrix with entries ZA. And now these equations become just the commutator of mu with rho is equal to the commutator of zeta with rho inverse. So these are the subtle equations written in a matrix form. And so to remind you what I'm trying to accomplish, we would like to show that solutions of these equations can be related to holomorphic curves in SL2C. More precisely, B-brains in SL2C. So one complex dimensional, let me say, so B-brains supported on holomorphic curves in SL2C with boundary, asymptotic boundary conditions controlled by these numbers, the Vs, the Zs, and the Ms. So remember, the Vs and the Zs enter in these matrices. The Ms are just the diagonal part of rho. I should include them in the equations. Okay. And any questions? You have. Okay, ominous. Yeah, so for each of these endpoints of the brain at the boundary of SL2C has a shape which is controlled by M, you know, M1, V1, V1. I don't think I will have time to discuss in detail how the holographic dictionary works in SL2C, but very roughly, it means that if I write the element in SL2C as G, perhaps I can even anticipate writing it as A, B, C, D, such that A, D minus B, C is 1. Then the boundary conditions are roughly telling you that G at the leading order is proportional to something like 1, Z, B, Z, V, plus something subleading, which is controlled by M. Times infinity, you know, it goes to infinity in that direction. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. In a sense, SL2C has a CP1 times CP1 boundary, where one of the CP1s is the holographic screen. And that's right, Z is the coordinate on that screen, V is the coordinate on the other CP1. And M is the slope in the normal direction. So the slope in the normal direction has two components, and M is one of the two components. Okay. So how do I get there? Well, when I see equations which have commutators, after living in the company of integrable system scientists, the first temptation is to write down some kind of a Lax matrix. So I'm going to introduce a spectral parameter A, which is going to live in C. And I'm going to write two matrices. B of A is something like, I will surely write it wrong, just, you know, I have the correct equation somewhere, but. Okay. Ignore the signs, I might have gotten them wrong. But the point is that these equations are equivalent to the fact that B of A commutes with C of A. Furthermore, the fact that I have a row here and a row inverse here means that I can write a matrix equation. Where D is another matrix that I can write down is something like, you know, A, zeta, mu plus mu rho minus rho inverse zeta, something like that. And once I had two matrices with a spectral parameter which commute, the next natural step is to diagonalize them, to look for common eigenvectors. So I can try to solve equations like B minus B of A acting on some vector equals zero. C minus C of A acting on the same vector equal to zero. And D minus D of A acting on the same vector equal to zero. And these equations, the solutions of these equations will give me a spectral curve, will give me a one parameter family of pairs, A, B, C, D, which satisfy A, D minus B, C equal to one. So I get an holomorphic curve in SL2C, which is precisely what I was looking for. So I might feel optimistic, perhaps. This could be the support of the D-brain, dual to the saddle. And notice being a spectral curve, it actually comes equipped with a line bundle, another ingredient I need to define a D-brain. But let me ignore that. So Kazi and I set up to find evidence that this is indeed the correct answer, that this is the shape of the saddle in SL2C. And we did the following tests, which seemed pretty convincing to me. So the first thing you can do, so there are sort of two different types of tests. So first of all, okay, a trivial check. When I go at large A, the matrices are dominated by the diagonal matrices. You can diagonalize them in perturbation theory. And you find that the asymptotic shape is precisely the one expected. Well, that's a good start. A richer check is that you can look at a correlation function of a bunch of determinants and a trace. Holographically, this should correspond to a situation where I have my D brain and I have a closed string. And the leading contribution to this, which is this diagram, should be the integral of the propagator, boundary to bulk propagator, over this holomorphic curve. And they also match at large N. And it's quite a nice calculation. So it turns out that you can rewrite this as a trace of a certain auxiliary matrix, which is built from rho. And although this matrix does not commute with B and C, it can be diagonalized with the help of this eigenvector. So there is sort of a geometric way to extract the eigenvalues from the spectral curve. And the geometric way really precisely matches the way you would do this calculation in the B model. You take the boundary to bulk propagator, which can be support. There are different gauge choices, but there's a gauge in which it's supported on a hyperplane. And so it sort of intersects the curve precisely at one point. And finding this point is the same problem that allows you to diagonalize the matrix which enter here. So this is a nice check. Another check that we did, although it was a bit incomplete, is that we found that, you know, the partition function has some interest at one loop part of the partition function has some interesting divergences whenever two components happen to meet at some point in the bulk, which is a non-generic thing because these are codimension two. I don't know. I don't know. It's one of those situations where something works, but you don't really understand why is it working. I would love to understand better the geometry. The matrix itself, it's some, let me see if I can find the form of the matrix. Sorry, I cannot find the matrix. Roughly, like the matrix looked like this. It's just rho inverse z minus zeta over v minus mu, perhaps the other way around. Anyway. It's an interesting object. I don't quite understand the full geometric story. Now, something that I want to do, but we did not fully do, is the opposite. So, right, so given a solution of this, we can find a spectral curve. But given a spectral curve, can we go back and find the saddle? This is a question we really like to understand because, right, in a sense, we don't fully understand the rules of which saddles contribute to a string theory or to a gravity path integral. So even if I find a D-brain in the bulk, I'm not guaranteed that it will actually contribute to the correlation function. So it's perfectly possible that some curves in SL2C will not contribute. And so I would love to know exactly if given a curve in SL2C, I can always find a saddle. So we did it for genus zero. If we have a genus zero spectral curve, I can find rho. It's a nice algebra calculation. We did not have the energy to do it for Hager genus, and I would love to, if somebody in the audience is enthusiastic enough to do it. Okay, I think, I don't know if there is time, but perhaps I can just discuss a few future directions that I would like to potentially see done. So within the context, you know, in the most strict mathematical context, obviously what would be wonderful would be to have a proof of this. It's in principle doable to show that the expansion of this correlation function around one of these saddles reproduces the B-model partition function in the presence of the D-brains. That will be sort of the ultimate mathematical calculation here. There are a variety of generalizations of the basic twist holography setup where you can add other brains or change the gauge theory. And there are variants of this story there, but I don't know how they work exactly. For example, if you take necklace quivers, you get SL2C mod ZN or SL2C mod NADE group. And it would be interesting to see how the spectral curves for that emerge from more complicated gauge theories. Getting outside the twisted holography setup, I think there are two sort of possible directions to get something more physical. But first of all, I think it's still possible that a similar strategy could be applied to the free nickel 4 superamines. And perhaps give hints of what the holographic dual looks like. This could be a test of these recent proposals by various authors. Second, I think it's conceivable that there should be some sort of a near twisted holography limit where these constraints on X and on the direction are imposed up to a small correction. It's not inconceivable that there should be a a systematic expansion, maybe in the product of this correction and the tooth coupling, and that this expansion might be meaningful even when the tooth coupling is large, if the deviation from the BPS limit is small. Something like, you know, has like something like it's done in other contexts in holography. And then perhaps one could study the correlation function. So then twist holography would give you the reference saddles, but you could study the full string theory, the full supergravity or string theory around those saddles. So as I was saying before, I don't quite know how to study the saddles when I turn on the generic interactions, but it should be possible to study it at least, to study a problem at least near, in a context where the saddles are close to these ones. A step that is required to do that, though, is to understand exactly the dictionary from SL2C to ADS5 times S5. So at the moment, I do not know what is the precise recipe that, given a spectral curve, produces an M4 inside ADS5 times S5. It should not be difficult. From the work of Mikhailov, people have found various ways to describe giant gravitons as holomorphic objects, but I haven't found in the literature the precise thing I need, which is to transform the giant graviton into an holomorphic curve in SL2C. So that's a piece of the dictionary between twist holography and real holography, which is still a bit weak. Okay, this is more or less all I wanted to say. Yes. Yeah, we did something about the global symmetries a little bit. Trying to remember what. There are, as I mentioned, there are sort of modification of determinants which represent the insertion of an open string that goes down along the D-brain. And when you act with a symmetry generator, you will produce such a, the symmetry generator will move a little bit at the endpoint of the D-brain, which corresponds to turning on a non-normalizable open string. And you can match the effect of the global symmetry transformations in the gauge theory and in the holographic dual. No, a deep brain saddle goes like to the end. Deep brain self tension 1/g. So it's always the case that in holography, adding a deep brain to a saddle shifts the action by a multiple of n. It's a disk. So it's genus 0, one boundary. The role of e to the n square saddles in the story, it's very obscure at the moment. There are definitely twist holography calculations which could in principle have contributions from other saddles. The very simplest is the correlation functions on a torus. These have a physical meaning too, because these are correlation functions on S1 times S3. And if the torus is very long and thin, then I can get a geometry by quotienting SHUC, but you know, I have no idea what happens when the torus is of generic shape. And I have not been strong enough until now to figure out the correct saddles here. So on the gauge theory side, I don't know what are the dominant saddles, and I don't know the Calabi-Yau geometries on the other side, which would match them. I think that's a very interesting direction to go. You can do that too. So that's we've been looking at with in the last few months. Some things work. We can repeat this whole story when one of the determinants is to the power of n. We can get, we know in that case, it's the geometry is kind of known, and you can check that you get spectral curve in that geometry. But whenever I have one more than one determinant to a large power, I start altering. The rho integral becomes a multi-matrix model essentially, and I have no idea how to solve them. I'll solve that. So I hear that there is some recent progress on solving multi-matrix models with bootstraps, so perhaps some numerical tools might be viable.